The Sour Hour is meant for the serious brewer. The Sour Hour may contain some seriously funkified content. The Sour Hour is not for the faint of heart. So exercise some damn discretion, would you please? Sheesh. And now, here's The Sour Hour with Jay Goodwin.
Alright, it's that time again. Back on The Sour Hour. Your host, Jay. Here with Scott Hiscott.
Hello.
Here with Bevo. Hey, Bevo.
Hey, Bev.
Still back there? She raised her hand.
She's here.
I'm here. Hi.
It's an audio podcast, actually, so.
Oh. You know.
Her hand,
well,
her
I'm
hand,
on video.
Her hand flew up. I'm here.
Bevo, present.
Present.
And we're here
more,
with Fallon.
More. Bueller.
More.
From Anderson Valley.
Hi,
also,
Fal.
How y'all doing?
Noted author.
Wow.
I note that you're an author, so that proves my point right there. Barley Wine, Goza, and now open in front of us, what kind of sounded like maybe a, I don't know if you would describe it as like a barrel-aged barley wine, but sour kind of thing here in front of us?
Yeah, you know,
is that fair?
This beer came about, we started a barrel program back in 2001, and a lot of people had, you know, they were like, what are you doing? And...
you were like, shut up.
I was like, ask Tommy what we're doing. He'll tell you. It actually, a lot of us back in the early 2000s had no idea what we were doing. And Tommy and Vinny had a pretty good idea what they were doing, sort of. But we all got together at the Tornado and organized a conference where we brought in some wood experts, barrel experts, and different people to talk about these things because we all didn't know as much as we would like to. That was pretty interesting. And out of that, we went back and bumped up our barrel program from 1 to 10 barrels. And so we had 10 barrels, you know, sitting around doing stuff. And I left Anderson Valley in 2005 and went to work in Asia for 5 years. I came back in 2010. And during that time, our production manager, Dave Gallen, decided that we should sour a barley wine. And they made a barley wine and ran it into a bourbon barrel and soured it. And they called the beer Gatlin Damnosis. And it's his favorite beer. And he's very tall, so there's a lot of body mass. He can put away a few of these, unlike a normal human. And this is Dave's favorite beer, so we continue to make it because Dave wants us to, and we don't want Dave to quit because he's awesome.
Also sounds like you don't want to mess with him either.
No, yeah. No. He's got reach on me, certainly, and, you know, he's probably much tougher than I am. He certainly is much tougher than I am because the job is much tougher than mine. Production manager is never... easy. But we make this beer, and we made a barley wine, and we run it into a fresh bourbon barrel and then sour it, which, of course, is really a stupid idea. You're making this gigantic beer, and then you're putting it into a fresh bourbon barrel with more alcohol, and then you're, you know, hoping that it'll sour.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it all with Pediococcus damnosus, hence the name Gatlin damnosus. And that bacteria doesn't like alcohol that much, and it certainly doesn't like hops, which we found out accidentally 1 year when we, you know, the brewer forgot that we were going to barrel it all and made a normal barley wine with hops.
Oh.
Which took, it's that beer is still trying to sour. But this beer takes 2 to 4 years to make for it to,
wow,
to get to its right spot. And when it's spot on, it is really quite an interesting beer. I think we're probably one of the few breweries stupid enough to make a sour barrel-aged barley wine, but there it is.
This is a fascinating palate experience. You tell me if you have the same experience, Jay, where you write it first, maybe on the aroma, and then when it initially hits your palate, you're like, oh, barley wine. You know, it's vanilla-y and bourbon-y.
Yeah.
And then the acidity hits you after you've swallowed it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that purposeful?
Purposeful? You mean like we had a plan?
Yeah.
No, it's one of the things that Dave likes about this beer is that it has the bourbon barrel-aged flavor up front, the aroma up front. And then when you, like you said, when you taste it, it's barley wine. But he likes sour beer as well, and so he really enjoys that. And purposeful, you know, our barrel program, very little is purposeful. We don't design the beers. The beers design themselves. We're like a shepherd herding his sheep across the field, and most of them go one way when we want them to go another. Eventually, they all get to the right place.
It's got a mind of its own.
Yeah.
Eventually, they're all a coat.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Well, and it's funny because it said, from reading from the side of the label here, in 2007, they said it couldn't be done. We set out to prove them wrong. And it meaning sour barley wine?
Yeah. The conventional wisdom, which is wisdom, is that you can't sour a, 8.5% beer, particularly when you put it in a fresh bourbon barrel.
Well, and I mean, not only the nuts and bolts problems of having it sour the way you want it to, but also making those flavor components meld together seamlessly. Acid and big malt, in other words, it's a lot easier to start with like a golden base, and then add some freaking fruit or something.
Is that a shot at me or what?
Yeah, man, that dark sour
golden,
base recipe.
Golden base and add fruit. That's that's our thing.
Boom.
But that's a thing that works. And most of the time, this doesn't work.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, going into it, I would be worried about a few things, I guess. And this beer is awesome.
Fantastic.
By the way.
Dave thinks so.
Yeah. I'd be worried, okay, we start, yes, with the higher alcohol. That's one thing to overcome to produce the acidity. But then you're also probably starting with quite a bit of sugar left in the beer, which, goes the opposite way. Okay, what if the Pediococcus is going to thrive in this environment? And there's a lot of, fermentable sugar to chew on and produce maybe too much acid. I think that's kind of where you get into. What's the plan versus what do the barrels tell us that they're doing? There's a wide range of outcomes when it comes to this beer. And then maybe I should just add one more thing on there. Is the bourbon barrel as a long-term storage vessel for sour beer, especially, a lot more oxygen ingress than at least compared to a wine barrel?
Yeah, Jay hates bourbon barrels.
Yeah.
I do, yes.
I don't know if I'd go all the way to hate, but yeah, they're not my favorite.
Well, just in the context of like versus wine barrels,
right?
I mean, they're dirty, they leak,
they're ugly.
They get lit on fire,
right. Yeah, from the inside.
Yeah, like the charring on the inside is out of control. There's no way to clean them once they're sour. That's it.
If you can somehow execute, you end up with this just wonderful like vanilla and
I love the
tobacco
beers. It's kind of the thing where I can appreciate them more because it's like, oh, I'm glad you did this because I'm good.
Totally.
But yeah, this beer. Well, I don't want to ask too many questions at once. So how do you guys troubleshoot some of those maybe potential issues when setting this out?
Well, we did have a little bit of a plan.
Huh?
We thought, as you said, there are going to be leftover sugars for the PDO to work on. And we figured that the PDO would top out somewhere. The alcohol would, overcome it at some point. And that seems to be the case because there is some residual sugar still floating around in there. This is not bone dry by any means.
I don't know if we mentioned it's 11.5%.
Yeah. It's a big beer.
Yeah.
And although Dave Gatlin can have 2 pints or 6 pints of it,
Dave's a tough guy.
I'm a 1 pint kind of guy on this beer. I got to drive home someday. They really frown on me sleeping in the office every night.
Should have stuck with pills.
Where's that Kolsch?
Yeah.
that was part of why we used PDO as opposed to lacto wasn't going to make it. And one of our challenges with this beer is that PDO will often, throw some diacetyl out there, and different strains will throw even more. Now, if you got Brett going on with that, Brett'll consume that diacetyl and reduce it down. Or if you got a good yeast going on there, you might get lucky and have it reduce some. But quite often, PDO will throw a lot of diacetyl out there, and that gets to be an issue with this beer. In the first year, it's way diacetyl. It's not really drinkable. So it's one of the things that takes a long time with this beer. That diacetyl has to work itself out.
Can I ask how often you're sampling it?
This beer, probably one or two times a year.
Just because it's just going to take a while.
Yeah. Most of our barrel beers, 3 or 4 times a year, depending on where they're going and, what we think's going on. Obviously, anything that gets fruit, we don't bother tasting it for 3 to 6 months. I mean, it's still working. There's no point in tasting it. We do once in a while, but there's no point.
Jay, do you think there's a point?
It depends. I mean, not to get too off topic, but our whole production is wrapped up around sour beer. So planning out packaging schedules for us, it's all dependent on the sour beer. So if after a month a fruit project has sulfur, we know it's going to take on maybe on the 6 month side of things rather than the 3 month side of things. That can help us with planning. So, but that's about it. Yeah, there's no real need to do it too often.
Yeah, we don't have those constraints. These beers, by and large, can sit as long as they need to, and mm-hmm. that's what ends up happening. You know, we taste them occasionally. You know, the two big lessons, and thank you, Vinny, Russian River Vinny, for these, Tommy too, is the two things that we've learned that we really have to do is top the barrels. You can't let oxygen get in there. You got to keep those barrels full. So you have to sacrifice, you know, some of the barrels as topping barrels. Mm-hmm. And we do that a lot, pretty aggressive about topping. And we're trying to do it as gently as possible. The stainless steel nail, you know, for tasting is huge, rather than sticking a wine thief in there and breaking the pellicle and messing all that up. So those are two really good things. And then temperature control, which at first we didn't really kind of grasp how dramatic that would be. But in our area, you know, we can have a 50-degree swing in temperature on, you know, some days. And quite often a 50-degree, you know, average temperature from winter to summer. So we get a huge coastal influence every evening. So we can hit 105 during the summer days, and then it can drop down to 55 at night.
On that same day, yeah, crazy.
And so we have put in a system. We have a separate barn for all our sour beers. It's done in a, you know, several hundred yards from our main brewery. I wish it was further away. Shit scares me to death. We have put in a system that, you know, the fans will go on. We have a winter setting and a summer setting. So in the summer, the fans go on at night and run all night until the outside temperature gets to a certain point. So we keep the beer cool that way, which is as important as keeping it warm in the winter. So when we fill barrels to sour in October or November, which we try not to because it's kind of pointless. They just sit for 3 or 4 months and don't do anything. They're just getting extra wood time, which for us isn't something we want. So we try and fill them in the spring so they can get warm and do their action over the summer. And, you know, then hopefully when a year rolls around, they're ready to package. Filling them in the fall just means they sit longer. So we try and keep it warm in the winter and cool in the summer. And temperature control has really made a difference in the number of barrels that go bad and the speed at which we're able to sour some of the beers.
Definitely. I think that's a key for all the beers, but also an excellent explanation on how to execute such a difficult beer like this. One thing I really love about, just kind of get into the flavor of this beer a little bit more, you know, we were talking off air during the break about how the Rare Barrel's doing some tart, hazy IPA kind of things.
In cans.
In cans.
That's nice. Right, cans.
That's right, cans. Coming after you, 21A.
isn't it crazy how that was like a big thing? Hey, craft beer in cans. People were like, huh? That was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Now it's ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people, are particularly Californians, are like, no. Yeah. No cans.
No cans. Yeah. Cans?
Now, cans.
In fact, Vinny, we were hanging out with Vinny just a couple nights ago, as we were saying at the top of the last show, and mm-hmm. he was saying that now his bottles pop because they're on a shelf full of cans.
Right, yeah.
Isn't that crazy?
We don't have that problem. Our bottles are not popping in a shelf full of cans. We don't even hardly use the bottle machine anymore.
Wow.
I mean, it used to be 60% of our sales.
Isn't that crazy?
Down to like 25 or something.
Isn't that wild? Yeah. Anyway, go on.
So, you know, the hazy IPA is a lot of big flavors, and we often do the base IPA, and we'll serve that in our tasting room, and then we'll blend in some barrel-aged sour beer to make the beer. And they're quite different. The tart IPA is not very sour at all, but just kind of takes the edge off and makes the whole big flavor a little more drinkable, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm drawing the connection with this beer, is that bourbon barrel-aged barley wine that's, you know, 11.5%, you know, maybe that's a little tougher pint to take down. This is probably a tough pint anyway, but I could drink more of this beer than probably the base barley wine because of just that little acidity.
So true.
Even more than like a sour beer, I think of it as like a way to make a more drinkable version of some of these really big beers that are out there.
Yeah, like kind of cleanses your palate, for lack of a better, you know, you swallow it and you're ready for the next sip, and barley wines can be a little cloying.
Yeah, when I started to get into cooking a little bit more, I noticed that one of my big issues was making things like just too savory overall. Then I realized, oh, this is why people have lemon juice and use vinegar and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Even though I didn't sound that good to me, you put a little bit of that in there. It's like, oh, this is balance.
A beer that's like this is Gale's Old Ale, you know, which is big, dark, and a little sour.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's one of my perennial favorites when I see it.
Absolutely.
I always grab one.
Yeah, this is really hitting the spot. But another dangerous one.
Yeah, 11 and a half. Whoa.
Should we take a break, Scott?
Let's do it, yes.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll be right back with Val on the Sour Hour.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Back on the Sour Hour, here with Val Allen from Anderson Valley Brewing Company. I'll just say we're switching it up a little bit with the beers, you know. Gotta break it up sometimes.
This beer is distinctly lacking in acidity.
Yeah.
Not sour. One star.
One star. We have the Extra Dry Brut IPA from Anderson Valley. We were kind of discussing the style a little bit off air.
Yeah.
Relatively new. You know, just another example of Northern California innovation in craft beer. Not a big deal. We also have, I'm going to say 15... years ago, maybe your Russell Scherer award for innovation is that. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, it may have been more than 15 years ago.
Okay,
He's not old. He's old school.
Yeah, old school.
I think I got that back in '99. So that's what is that? That's 20 years, isn't it?
Yeah. Wow.
See, I was a sophomore in high school, and Jay was in eighth grade.
Shockingly, I was a sophomore in high school then.
Yeah.
Oh wait, no.
Really killing it. Yeah. But yeah, what's your interpretation of the style?
Our interpretation, it should be Kim's interpretation. Mm-hmm. Kim at Social Kitchen kind of really invented this style. And
I should say a free agent as of a little while ago.
Oh, is that right?
A free agent.
Mm-hmm.
But I went, you know, I grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, and a friend of mine, Bob, puts on the Hilo Beer Fest, and I'd been threatened to come out to it for a while. And
I'm going to be there. Get ready.
I'll come, really. And last year, I decided that, you know, I had been dinking around enough. So I went out to the Kona Beer Fest and then flew back and went to the Hilo Beer Fest. And I was at the Hilo Beer Fest, and there's a new brewery out of Oahu, which is, you know, the island that Honolulu is on, a brewery called Lanikai Brewing. And a guy named Steve is the brewer owner there. And I tasted a Brut IPA that he'd had. And I'd heard of this. I'd had Dick Cantwell's, and I was intrigued by the idea of this beer. And when I tried the Lanikai one, I was completely blown away. I kept going back to his booth and saying, I need another one. And I had a bunch. And then at the end of the festival, my friend Bob, who puts it on, has this beautiful home overlooking the Hilo Bay. And he gets all the brewers together that want to come over to his house. And they come over and drink the leftovers. And
now that sounds awful.
It was horrible. Volcano was erupting, so you could see this glow, red glow in the sky across the bay. And we're sitting at Bob's house, and the keg of the Lanikai Brut shows up, and there's not much left, but there's a little bit, and I'm having one after the other. No, I was not toasty. And Steve from Lanikai shows up, and we got to talking about it, and then he'd done a whole bunch of research. He talked to Kim and done a bunch of research on the enzyme and all this stuff, and he's like, well, I'll email you, you know, mm-hmm. all the stuff I found out. And he did a couple days later. So I got home and got this email. I was like, well, now I got no excuse not to do it. So thanks to Steve, we, you know, really had a foot in the door as to how to make this beer. I think the hallmark of this beer is its dryness. And, mm-hmm. you know, we were talking a little earlier, Jay, and you were saying, well, does it have to be crystal clear? And I don't think it does. It shouldn't be milkshakey, but, you know, certainly one of the things that I think people don't, you know, consumers, I'm sure brewers get this, but consumers don't get is that haze in any beer it carries other things with it. There's a flavor contribution that haze brings with it. If you take a beer and it's hazy and you drink it and you love it, and then you filter that beer, you know, two things will happen, one positive, one negative. The positive is it pulls out all that haze, which is chalky and mouth coating on your tongue. And that's the negative part. It also pulls out some flavor, particularly hop flavor and aroma, and that's the negative part. So your clarifying of a beer becomes important in a lot of ways. And
maybe a little improvement in shelf stability.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, forget about all that shelf stability stuff. Yeah, those hazy beers, I mean, the really hazy ones, they're not going to do well. They're not going to age well out in the market in a bottle or a can or even a keg. And that's a problem, I think, you know, for consumers. But that's a whole other topic of discussion. But when you have a hazy beer, you know, it's got some of that chalkiness and some of that in there. And I don't think that particular flavor quality belongs in a super dry brewed IPA. So a little haze, I think, is fine. But super hazy, I think, is probably problematic for that style just because of the nature of what that haze brings to the beer. And I like the fact that it's got a little bit of a reduced bitterness to balance out. I mean, you can't have too much bitterness with that much dryness. So I think what you end up is a very sessionable, very crushable IPA that's got a lot of aroma and, you know, a moderate amount of alcohol. It's not overdone and super dry and drinkable. And that's mm-hmm. what I love about this style. And when we made it, thank you, Steve, for giving us some pointers on how to do it. And I think we came up with a very sessionable, very dry version of this. I like it.
Yeah, being outside on a bench drinking this on a hot day sounds pretty good to me right now.
Just for context, it's 6.8%.
Yeah, 6.8, and it finishes up at 0 degrees Plato or maybe 0.2. So that's pretty dry. And yet, when you drink it, you know, I think the alcohol that there tricks your tongue into thinking there's some residual sweetness after you swallow.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
for sure.
But there's not much sugar left in there. I think the highest we've had it is 0.6%, you know, Plato. Pretty dry beer.
Let's contrast that with some of the other beers you're putting in cans, including the Goza. So we've had, and for context, I don't think we really hit too fine of a point on this, but the Brut IPA, the Goza are in cans.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The current beer and the barley wine, Star Barley Wine, were both in bottles.
Yeah, big bottles, which hopefully will change into 500 mil bottles sometime this year.
Oh, that's cool.
And those were 22s capped.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. What's the, you know, we kind of touched on shelf life for a brief moment there. What do you think, what are you seeing with these beers and how they're aging over time from the Goza in cans to kind of the mixed culture or barrel-aged beers that you guys put in bottles?
The mixed culture beers, I believe the shelf life's pretty close to infinity. I pulled a sour beer that we made 6 years ago out of my fridge the other day. And true, it's been in my fridge for the whole 6 years, but it was in a growler.
Wow.
And had it with a bunch of people. And it was as good or better than it was 6 years ago.
In a growler?
In a growler. I know. It still
no
had
kidding.
Carbonation.
Is that right?
No, it's a bad idea. I don't recommend that anyone ever do it. But, you know, as a brewer, I filled it all the way to the top. I mean, you know, the ewelage, that space between the neck and the cap was very small.
That's called ewelage?
Ewelage.
Am I just dense that I've not heard that before? Are you familiar?
No, I've never heard that.
Ewelage.
Yeah, I believe that's an old brewer term.
Old school.
I'm an old brewer.
School. Old school brewer mm-hmm. term.
hey, listen, I'm not as old as Mark Carpenter. who, by the way, I'll be on the radio with tomorrow in Santa Rosa.
We love Mark.
Yeah, we do love Mark. But I am old.
Mark was on the session in that same bedroom in the same year in 2011.
Really?
Wow. Yes.
He rocks.
He's the man. He was old school then.
he and Brian Hunt are like super old school because those guys came right out of college and, you know, in the 70s and went to work at a brewery. Boom.
Yeah.
And, you know, they got between them. You know, they probably have more than 70 years of brewing,
wow,
you know, going on. Both super nice guys and great brewers. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to be, you know, be on that show tomorrow with Mark.
What show?
It's the Brouhaha. You know, it's Steve Jackson has the drive every day up there on KRSO.
Oh, on Real Radio.
Yeah.
Oh, good times.
Yeah, yeah. What? We're not live here?
No, we're just having a discussion here.
Oh, it's podcast.
Yeah, podcast. I don't know if the old school guys know what podcasts are.
What is that?
It's like radio on the ultranet.
What? What's an ultranet?
On the intro.
You see how old school he is. What is that? Yeah, the inner tubes.
Okay. Now I forgot where we were.
Sorry, Mark?
We were talking about shelf life.
Yeah, shelf life. So I think for a lot of sour beers, particularly well-made ones, the shelf life is near infinity. A lot of them, you actually even get better if they're stored at the right temperature. I'm sure you guys experience this with your sour beers. Sour, you've already fermented out most of the sugar. There's already bacteria in it. It's pre-infected for your pleasure. And it's not going to, you know, unless something is really funky in there, it's not going to get worse. It's only going to get better. And the oxygen gets absorbed by whatever yeast is in there, probably. Shockingly, something that we didn't expect is that Goza shelf life is easily a year or two. I have a 5-year-old Goza in my fridge, which I'm hoping to try sometime later this week.
What's going
or next
on
week.
In this fridge?
It must be very big. A lot of square footage in there.
I don't want to see the loaves of bread in there.
Oh, right?
Different fridge.
Old growlers sitting there.
Thankfully, that's a different fridge. Yogurt, old bread.
Yeah.
It smells right, like a 14th century English town.
Yeah.
The food one does, sadly. The beer one is sparkling clean.
Yeah.
I'm a hoarder. That's a fact.
You can also look for Fal coming up on an episode of Hoarders.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably.
It'll be fun.
I pity when I pass and my nephew has to take care of the crap that I've accumulated. I Patrick, I'm sorry. I apologize now. But yeah, you know, but I think a brewery should always have a library and store your beers and kind of get a feel how they behave warm and cold. I'm always blown away. We do this every month. We try a beer from our library, warm and cold, and I'm always blown away by the difference and how much better the cold does. With a few exceptions, the warm for the barrel-aged sour beers does better than the cold because it's aging. Mm-hmm. Things are still going on in there. And the Goza, usually cold is better, but we see them a year or two out, and there's just not much to oxidize. There's very little hops. You know, and the problem with the IPA craze, or IPAs in general, is that the first thing to fall apart in a beer is the hop aroma and flavor, and then, you know, the bitterness. And those things oxidize pretty quickly. So even under your best conditions, a six-month-old IPA is kind of worn out, unless it's really been cold the whole time. Certainly a year-old IPA, I'm not going to bother with. So it's hard to, when craft beer is selling so much IPA, to have basically a beer that is your most vulnerable out there. You know, the more hops you have, the more you have to oxidize. And I have come to find that caramel malt seems to oxidize in an odd way, which I don't like. So a super dark beer, like a stout, I think you're good. Those color components are oxygen receivers, and the beer doesn't oxidize as much or show oxidation as much. But caramely beers seem to oxidize more. And so your worst-case scenario is kind of your caramely hoppy beer, which a lot of breweries, particularly old-school ones, made those IPAs back in the day, caramely hoppy IPAs. And those things, their shelf life is, you know, a couple months tops. You know, even refrigerated 6 months is, you know, it would be impressive. I'm excited that lighter IPAs are out there. I think that's a great
Absolutely.
Trend. More reasonably hopped IPAs are beginning to be a thing, and I think that's a great, you know, a great change. Session IPAs, or which are basically hoppy pale ales, a great thing. And just the return of low alcohol session beers is a great thing, and low alcohol sour session beers.
Mm-hmm.
Did it surprise you that the Gozas have been aging well?
Yeah, very much. The first time I popped one open, I was thinking, this is going to be like hell on wheels. And I drank it, and I thought, huh, you know, no oxidation. And, it had some issues. It was, you know, I think it was 6 months warm, which is a long time to be warm. And our warm is, you know, 80 to 100 degrees. And so I thought it'd show more. For example, a hop out an IPA from that same, you know, 3 to 6 months up there in that hot storage, that stuff is, you know, it's barely drinkable. You know, it's caramely hoppy beer. Cold stored, it's pretty good, but not hot. So I was really surprised that Goza's aged so well. And I think there's not much sugar in there. They're very dry. They're pre-infected. They're already acidic. There's not a lot that's going to grow in there. So if you do have any bacteria, that's, you know, not going to be as much of an issue. And there's just not that much to oxidize.
Just another reason to pick up several six packs of Goza when you see them out there on the show.
Yeah, whenever you see it.
And I think a few things I want to do, Scott. One is, you know, I don't know how much we've actually gotten into the Anderson Valley Goza process. You know, after you started doing this, you've done the book. Now, how have things changed? Let's maybe talk about that in our last segment. Let's also maybe tease a question. This question and all questions are brought to you by Dr. Lambic and his team at sourbeerblog.com. Check out the articles in Sour Beer Blog for a great written resource devoted to teaching you how to brew and blend sour beer at home, or if you're a pro. Great resource for that, too. And now Sour Beer Blog crew is opening up a brewery. In fact, it's already open. A brewery and taproom in central Pennsylvania. Mechanicsburg, I think.
Yes, yes.
Check them out. Mellow Mink Brewing at mellowmink.com.
We don't even have to tease this, Jay, because it's not a question. It's, in fact, a sort of pointer comment from Evan Andrasson. This is an episode 100. We read a question. If you remember, we were a little surprised that he wrote us about it because it was not necessarily a sour question. Evan says, about the new brewer who got a 1020 reading for a 1050 batch. It could have been a reading of hot wort instead of cooled down. At 185 degrees, 1050 wort would measure right at 1020. Seems more likely than having a 30% extract efficiency, which is what we had sort of said might have been going on there. Mm-hmm. So that's a note for the fellow who wrote in about his wort not being at the target, not even close.
Great. And I absolutely remember that.
There you
as
go.
I do with everything
he impeccable
said.
Memory, yes.
Fowl remembers everything he wrote in the book. We are, you know,
I
for a couple
nothing.
Of tacks here.
That
so.
Is right. All right. Well, thanks, Dr. Lampick, for bringing us that comment from Evan.
Fowl, do you have anything else?
Yeah, I want to say the Sour Beer Blog guys,
yeah.
They were very helpful when I was writing the book, as well as Milk the Funk.
If yes.
If people don't know about that resource, oh my. But both those blogs are really good.
Excellent. We've had both of them on the show, actually.
Yeah. I'm hoping that we haven't gotten anyone out there has gotten past 100 episodes of the Sour Hour and is not familiar with Milk the Funk. That's a fail fish on your part.
I saw some comment that someone showed me somewhere where it was like they were talking about things that used to be talked about on the Milk the Funk Facebook group. And they were like pre-Kvetke yeast, pre-Jay mentioning this on the Sour Hour, something like that. Because when they came on, they did a great job on the show, which is why their membership exploded. But I think they're like 10 times bigger since that time.
Is that right?
Seriously.
No kidding.
And it's a great partnership between Sour Hour, Sour Beer Blog, and Milk the Funk. And also, you know, the individual authors that are coming out with Goza. And we had Tonsmeyer on the show.
Oh, yeah.
American Sour Beers.
Great book.
And it's just all that coming together. Now Sour Beer is in its apex of information availability.
Indeed.
It's a really exciting time.
It's cool to be a part of that. Yeah.
Yeah. For sure.
This is Brewers Publications, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, God bless them.
And, you know, the Milk the Funk guys, the Sour Beer Blog guys, so many people contributed to this book, were so helpful. And I was really, you know, we are in a great industry where people come together and share information that way. And I always like to encourage other brewers to, you know, if you got a problem or a question, reach out to your fellow brewers, reach out to your neighbor. And I encourage those people get reached out to respond in a positive way, because we're all a community. You know, high tide floats all boats.
For sure.
Indeed.
Yeah. And that's a great thing about our industry.
I like to say the best brewers don't mind asking questions or even saying, you know, hey, I don't know the first thing about this.
Yes.
Yeah.
And some of the worst ones are the ones that are too prideful to ask, and they think they know. And every great brewer, every brew master I talk to is always, you know, you never stop learning.
No.
And there's always a little edge you can get. You know, Michael Jordan didn't stop being good in 1990. You know, he got even better, even though, you know, you're the best player in the NBA. So
there's an old aphorism: the easily embarrassed do not learn.
Yeah. Just embrace it.
Yep.
And then it's hilarious.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. People, it's very endearing if you just go with it. I'm a little remiss that it took me, you know, until like my 30s basically to figure that out. Like, people actually just like that.
Well, see, you're still learning though.
Yes, I am.
A lot of people have a lot to tell you, and I'm always surprised, you know, you go to some place and somebody shows you something new and you think, wow, you figured that out and you didn't expect them to. And you can learn new things from anybody. You know, they don't have to have been in the business a long time.
Off air, Scott and Fowl, we're talking about how to cheat at blackjack at casinos, and
counting cards is not cheating, Jay. Okay, it's just beating the game.
Yeah, All right.
You got to take an edge somewhere.
Yeah. We're going to get into the ghost process.
Let's do
finally.
That. Let's take a quick break. Great hosting by us. Quick break. We'll be right back on the Sour Hour. Sour Hour. Lucky enough to have Val here for a long time. He's been hanging in there with us, which is always great.
Oh, yeah. Stamina, I got.
That's excellent, because now we have another one of your beers, the Boonville Gold.
Yeah, it's another non-sour beer, but I'd just like to give a shout-out to Jesse at Almanac for making this delicious Sunshine and Opportunity beer that I'm having right now next to the Boonville Gold.
Oh, yeah. What were you saying? It's a peach and...
It's pear.
Pear.
It's
okay.
Pear. It's sour, and it's bready, and it's delicious.
Awesome.
I mean, come on.
Great beer.
I know.
Yeah. Their hoppy beer has been on point lately, too.
Really?
Yeah.
Boonville's very small. We don't get a lot of really... we don't get anything out there. Coors Light comes through there quite often.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
But I've had that before.
Well, speaking of Boonville, this is the Boonville Gold.
Boonville Gold, yeah.
And, you know, I think some people might not know about the beer festival.
Really?
Who doesn't know?
People not from California? Mm. I mean... Yeah,
they're going to have to wait a whole year to come to the next one. But if you would like to come to the Boonville Beer Festival, now is the time to make your reservations at local hotels. Because they'll be sold out in a few minutes.
No kidding. It's April? When is it every year?
It's the last part of April or the first part of May. And we kind of have to shift it around sometimes. I believe next year is the first weekend of May. You know, because of the CBC, the Craft Brewers Conference, and Mother's Day, and a few other things that happen around there, we have to move it around. This year was the last week in April. This year was fabulous. The weather was perfect. It was supposed to be rainy. I think that kept the attendance down a little bit. I think we were maybe 300 to 500 people short from last year, which was mayhem. mayhem is not a good thing. Well, you know, sometimes. But the Boonville Beer Festival is unusual in several ways. One, the majority of the people that go to it camp out. We camp over 1,000 people on our property. They're brewers and friends of brewers. We have 85 breweries that come up. And so if you want to try 85 different beers, we have no pour limit. We just give you a glass and you taste what you want. We have two stages with multiple bands. A lot of the brewers will bring things that they don't normally pour, so there are unusual beers there. The attendees have their own campsite. They camp about 3,000 people, and talk about mayhem. I went there once. I'm still trying to recover from the shock of it. And so, you know, it's a good weekend, particularly if the weather is nice like this year. It was, you know, high 70s, low 80s, sunny, and just a beautiful setting to have a beer fest at the Mendocino County Fairgrounds in Boonville, and we provide bus service up and down the valley. So if you're staying at one of the few motels or campgrounds down in the valley, you can get there for free to the beer fest and back.
Yeah, highly recommended. Great time to come out and also visit Anderson Valley.
Yeah, yeah. And we, you know, this was a record year. We had zero arrests. So that's pretty good. You know, the local constabulary set up and randomly pull over people leaving the beer fest. And so we encourage everybody not to drive. And that's why we have the beer service and there's a rickshaw service. But occasionally a few people insist on driving and they get pulled over and off to jail they go. And those, you know, the brewery, or actually the festival, the brewery doesn't have to, but the festival has to pay for each one of those people who gets arrested, unfortunately. So this year with a zero arrest, we just have that much more money we've raised to donate. And all the profits from this go to local charities. So we contribute about $100,000 a year to local charities for money raised during the beer fest.
Wow, that's a fortune.
Yeah, we've donated over $1.2 million.
Wow.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Good on you. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about
Goza?
Huh? What?
Now, we've obviously covered plenty, but not plenty, plenty.
We've covered Blind Pig.
Yeah, we have. Was that on the air or off? I can't remember now.
I can't either.
But let's maybe walk people through the process of making Goza at Anderson Valley specifically. You know, we talked about, I think, the early days of, hey, let's do this sour mash, and then you guys transition it to the kettle. But now, kind of more lately, post-book, you know, what has changed? What did you learn to improve your process? And we can also assume that a lot of the listeners have, they know a lot, some of the kind of essential basics of, you know, wort souring and things like that. But as much depth as you want to go into, I think would be very helpful for those who are interested in this style.
You know, I outline several different ways to sour your wort in the book. So if you don't have the book, you should. If you're serious about making sour beer,
buy the book.
But Anderson Valley has come up with a method. I don't think it's the best by any means, but I think it works the best for us. Each brewery needs to decide what's going to work best for them. Our system, I talked to the guys at Sierra Nevada, also very, very nice, very forthcoming with their information. They do a different process than we do, and that's what works best for them. And it's, you know, there is no right process. There's just right for you.
Where does their process differ from yours?
They are deathly afraid of sour bacteria, and who can blame them? I think Ken is smart to be afraid. We should all be afraid of, unless that's all you do is sour beer, then you don't need to be afraid.
Then you're just smart.
Jay embraces it. Embrace the funk.
Yeah, exactly. So jealous. Really think, you know, and Firestone Walker has really done it right. They just have two whole breweries yeah. now. One makes sour beer and one makes non-sour beer, and they're like in a different zip code, which is, that's the correct way to do it, you know.
They just want Jim as far away as possible.
Exactly. Well, you know, we talked about that funky sour in your bar, you know, in the middle ages. So
shout out to Jim Crux.
Jim Crux.
Yeah, Jim is awesome. Jim, thank you also. He sent a recipe in for this book. A lot of really great brewers sent in recipes for the book, so it's filled with interesting recipes as well. But at Anderson, you know, their process is they're afraid of the lacto, and I don't blame them. So they do a whole separate off kind of separate souring, and then use that to sour. You know, they boil it and kill all the bacteria, and then use that to sour the main brew, and that works well. And some people use acidified malt and have good results with it. Some people have used just adding lactic acid, you know, at some point in the process and had some decent results. I think that having the bacteria actually produce the acidity gives it a lot more depth and complexity that you don't get by just adding lactic acid. Our process is what I think is certainly the easiest, maybe not the best, but we do regular mash. We mash in. We run off into the kettle. At that point, the wort that we run off is too hot to add the bacteria to. So we intentionally high gravity brew into the kettle. Then we'll water back with our house water to get it down to the right gravity and temperature. And then we'll put in a giant pitch of lactobacillus bacteria, slightly over what we'd use for pitching beer with yeast. So yeast pitches, you know, 1 million cells per ml per degree Plato. And so we do slightly like 1.1 or 1.2 million cells of bacteria per ml per degree Plato. So it's a lot, a huge pitch. And the huge pitch has a lot of good things about it. The two things that you want to do to keep from creating funky, and when I say funky, I mean not good funky, bad funky flavors in your beer with these sorts of beers is drop your acidity as rapidly as possible and exclude oxygen. So we run off into the kettle. We put a massive pitch in. We blanket the top of the kettle with nitrogen or argon, both inert gases. I think argon's vaguely cheaper at this point, so we use that sometimes. And then that massive pitch gets the pH dropping pretty quickly. So once it's below 5, you're in pretty good shape. And once it gets below 4.8, you know, you're doing a lot better. And that, as the acidity goes up or the pH goes down, you start to exclude certain types of bacteria that make these weird, funky flavors that you don't want. And a little bit of that is nice. You know, at super low levels, some of these weird things get kind of a guava-y note or a fruity note, and that's kind of interesting, but you don't want too much, certainly. So we drop that pH as fast as we can, and we usually can do it in 6 to 12 hours. And I, you know, I've talked to some brewers who are doing it over 2 or 3 days, mm-hmm. and that's a long time. It ties up your kettle for a long time, or whatever you're using, you know, to sit in.
What's your target pH that you're going for?
Somewhere between 3.4 and 3.2. Mm-hmm. 3.2 is kind of low. We prefer a little bit above that. 3.4 is getting a little bit up there. We don't want above that. 3.5 maybe. But if we're doing multiple batches into one fermenter, 2 or 3 batches, then you can blend up a little bit and even things out. So if you get one that's 3.2 and one that's 3.4, it works out perfect.
Do you consider whether it's going to become, for lack of a better term, plain goza versus a fruited type, or you're going for that range, and once you hit it, you're good to go?
The latter. All our base gozas are the same. The original goza is the same as all the others, except for we differ only in the fruits that we add. The process and the targets and the malt bill are all the same. That's not entirely true. Every once in a while, we'll do something that is completely intentionally different, but that hasn't worked out all that well for us, so we just try and keep it the same. But once we hit that target pH, we turn on the boil, we boil it, and that kills all the lactobacillus bacteria. Doesn't remove them from the process, it just kills them, and we then, you know, ship it over to a fermentation like any other beer.
What is, just quickly to interject, what about hops? So I assume you know, the first go around, maybe there's none.
Zero.
And yeah. Then what about on that subsequent boil that is the kill step of the lactobacillus?
Once it's soured, you know, there's no hops in it previous to souring. Once it's soured, we can then add whatever hops we want. And that's one of the great things about this process, is that you're able to sour the beer without having to worry about the hops inhibiting it. So if you want to make a hoppy goza, which I don't recommend, but you know, maybe some people want to, maybe a lightly acidic goza with hops in it would be good. When your pH gets below like 3.5, you know, down into the 3.2 area, the bitterness and the sourness don't really go so well together, I think, and our taste panel thinks. But you know, once you've soured it, you're free to do whatever you want hop-wise. And that, I think that's a good thing about this process. And then we ship over and ferment with our house yeast. And that goes perfectly fine the first time around. It goes horribly wrong the second time around. So we don't reuse that yeast. That yeast is essentially burnt by the acidity. It makes perfectly fine beer that first time. But when we repitch that yeast, it does make beer. You can drink it, but you're not going to like it. So it does present a problem for us that we can't repitch that yeast. So the more goza we make, the more yeast propping we have to do.
Sure.
But the ferment goes off perfectly fine. And like you, we add the salt at the end of fermentation. Mm. We add the salt and the fruit together usually. We do it at the very end of fermentation. And we do it there because initially we assumed that the yeast would ferment the fruit sugars out. But I don't think that happens. I don't see any more evolution of CO2 after we add the yeast. I mean, after we add the fruit. What I do see, you know, is if you take hydrometer readings, you see the gravity go up when you add the fruit, and then you see it drop down either to where it was before or sometimes actually below. Mm-hmm. And my assumption is that the yeast is taking that sugar on board in preparation for going dormant. You know, I know that's a thing that yeast does. They store glycogen and sugar. And I assume that's what's happening. I assume that's where that sugar is ending up. It's ending up in the yeast, which is a good thing. You don't want it left in your beer for all kinds of reasons. We don't want the sweetness, and we don't want the additional fermentability later on in case we get an infection. That works really well. Adding the salt to the cold side, I think, is good. It doesn't interfere with fermentation that way. And something that we hadn't thought about until I started writing the book is that stainless is not really stainless. It stains, and it doesn't like a whole bunch of things. It doesn't like to be heated up and cooled down. It makes it brittle. It doesn't like salt of any kind. You know, it doesn't like the chlorine in it. And, you know, when you're adding your salt on the hot side, you're potentially damaging your kettle. But even worse is you're potentially damaging the stainless of your heat exchanger, which to me is the most frightening, because that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. If you got a clean and intact heat exchanger, you're in good shape. But once you're a heat exchanger, which, you know, the metal's already thin because it's meant to exchange heat. Once you get a problem in there, you're done. Every beer you run through, it's going to have issues.
Maybe some that you don't notice right away also.
Absolutely. You know, you could have a low-level infection in your heat exchanger and not know it for months, and those beers will not taste as good, and probably subsequently out in the market, the infection will show itself even more. So I think it's really important to keep your heat exchanger super clean, and putting salt through it just makes me super nervous because, you know, I talked to a bunch of metallurgy guys and welders and, you know, different people, and they all said the same thing that, yeah, if you're going to use salt, 304 stainless is not your choice. And that's basically what all brewing equipment is 304, you know, maybe some 316. But I worry about it. So putting it in on the cold side is way safer. You're not going to have the same reactions because it's colder temperatures, and you're not going to be running it through your heat exchanger.
Yep. And what batch sizes are we talking about when you're doing the salt addition? What's like a good kind of maybe metric for people to work off of on a pound, probably maybe even not even that much, but like, you know, weight per BBL, weight per volume, and then how do you have it well integrated? You know, you're saying you're adding it at the, you know, kind of back half of fermentation. I think there's some kind of natural mixing going on in the fermenter, but are you doing any how do you make sure that the salt gets everywhere?
I just want to point out that as Jay was asking that numbers-based question, Fal reached for his own book and started flipping through. Let me see.
That's a good thing I'm not on the show, because if anyone asked me, so Jay, on this beer, what's how many pounds per gallon of fruit?
And I'll just be Jay's thing is ask my lackeys, man.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Let me text Tommy real quick. Let's cut this out.
I don't recall how many grams per gallon or liter we use. It's in the book. I mean, it's not like I'm trying to keep any secrets.
Google it.
It's in the book.
No, it's not on Google. It's only in the book.
If you can find that picture in the book, there's a salt section that'll tell you how much. I don't recall. I want to say something like 28 grams per gallon, but maybe that comes from a different experience in my life, the 28 grams part.
I was going to say.
I got myself a lid.
How much, what was the other part of the question?
How is it incorporated?
Oh, and how has it, good question.
And, you know, I assume you have kind of a large batch going.
Yeah, we do, our brew house is 100 barrels, so we do one, 2, and 300 barrel batches of Goza, quite often a 300 barrel batch, so it's three brew house brews into a fermenter. We have a special tank we bought for adding fruit and salt, and yeah, we got it made up. It's got a mixer in it. And so we'll put the salt or the fruit into this smaller tank that's on wheels that we can wheel around and let it mix for quite a while, you know, put some water in there. And we brew a gravity, so we take this into the consideration so we won't be watering down the beer. But we, you know, dissolve the salt or the salt and fruit together in an aqueous solution and then inject it into
just hot liquor?
Yeah. And by the time we finish mixing it, it's no longer hot enough to matter. And we're putting it into, you know, warm beer. It's not like it's chilled cold beer.
Sure.
So we then inject it in, and maybe out of, who knows how many batches of Goza we've made, but a very small percentage. Every once in a while, we'll see that it didn't homogenize properly in the tank.
This is pump in or pressure transfer?
Pressure. We blow it in through the bottom.
Oh, through the bottom.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we have, or through the racking arm, depending on, with the racking arm up, depending on the tank. And then we will blow a little being the operative word, a bit of CO2 to kind of drag that up. And we'll do that through the bottom sometimes. But it pretty much wants to be in solution. And unless you didn't get it fully dissolved earlier, it pretty much goes into solution pretty easily. And then when you transfer the beer or you centrifuge the beer or you filter the beer or whatever you do with the beer afterwards, that helps to homogenize it. Mm. Even if you do get some stratification, which happens with beers that don't have fruit in them, you get, you know, thermal stratification or other types of stratification. Moving it to another tank homogenizes it. So usually that resolves the issues.
That's something I didn't think about, because sometimes we'll do those types of infusions in our pet, like in the same tank that we package out of.
Yeah.
That I think the transfer kind of solves all those problems.
Right. And we now centrifuge pretty much, you know, not sure I'm going to say 100% of our beers, but the vast majority of our beers get centrifuged. So
not the hazy IPA.
No. That may be an issue.
Dot.
Yeah. We are making one. We are coming out with a hazy IPA.
Breaking news? Breaking network?
Exclusive?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Fowl would know the details about the hazy IPA, but the records burned in a fire.
Yeah, they burned. Yeah.
when I touched them, they spontaneously self-combusted. You shall not know. Yeah, centrifuging is a great way to homogenize everything. I mean, you spin it around and then pump it into another tank. Mm-hmm. So we quit filtering beers by and large unless we do a small batch. So we have three brew houses. We have a half barrel, a 8 barrel, and a 100 barrel. And occasionally the 8 barrel will get filtered depending on the beer. Mm-hmm. But other than that, we don't filter any of our production beers anymore. It's all just spun into a conditioning tank.
Gotcha. All right. I think that's a thorough rundown of the Goza. I think
we're running up against it. Indeed we are. Thanks.
Industry term.
Yummy.
Got to finish up with one of our...
The question.
One of our favorites. Val, what do you think the biggest mistake in sour beer making is?
The biggest mistake that a brewer could make or that I've made?
could be.
Well,
either.
You're a brewer, so same.
No, he's a master.
Yeah, a master brewer, yes.
I don't know about that. I know we outlined some of the things that I think that are important to keep in mind. I know the biggest mistake. I think I don't want to harsh on anybody. In the world.
You can name names.
I don't know. I can't name names.
The rare barrel.
I can't.
Jake Goodwin.
I think you alluded to this a little bit. Not so much now in my experience out drinking, but 5 years ago, I think some of the people making sour beers were mistaking acetic acid for lactic acid, and they are not the same thing. Acetic acid is vinegar, and it tastes like vinegar, and you have it in, you know, your stomach acid is acetic acid, and lactic acid is a totally different kind of acid. And the quality of acids, I think, is something that beginning sour brewers don't appreciate. Every type of acid is very different. You know, hydrofluoric acid is way different than, say, you know, citric acid. And different types of acid are very, very different. Hydrofluoric will eat almost anything, including tile. It's like something out of Alien. And, you know, you definitely don't...
school reference.
You don't want that in your beer. And
is that a superhero
movie?
Are you
talking about the alien or the acid?
Neither, man. That'd be messing you up.
It's going to pop out of your stomach.
You know that scene where that little alien shoots out of his... That was just too much sour beer.
Yeah. That does not hold up special effects-wise.
No, it really doesn't.
I just watched that like a month and a half ago.
But, you know, acetic acid is produced by Acetobacter, which needs oxygen to make that acid. And lactic acid is very different. Lactic acid is very clean, soft, lemony, and acetic acid is vinegary and harsh and very, very tart. And a little bit of acetic acid does, in fact, lend itself to some fullness in your beer. So a touch of it is quite nice, like opening a bottle of red wine and letting it breathe for a moment. You know, letting it breathe for an hour is great. Letting it breathe for 3 days means you ended up with oxidized, you know, red wine. And the same thing is true with acetic acid. A little bit of it opens up the beer and gives it some nice roundness. But too much of it just means that you got an acid bomb that tastes like, you know, fish and chips vinegar. And you can't, I don't like drinking it. It's just too harsh on your throat. And I think a lot of brewers, 5 years ago, I think a lot of people have learned, but some people maybe still not, you know, grokking that those are two different types of acid. They're produced in two different processes, and one is to be avoided for the most part.
It's crazy how unpleasant acids were, like, I don't know, perceived as desirable, I guess. You know, just getting handed, you know, beers at the SoCal Homebrewers Fest 9 years ago, and it was either...
Shout out to SoCal.
Yeah, shout out to, right. And it's not to specify, I mean, it was not unique to that festival, but acetone and acetic. Mm-hmm. But just like any acid was good. Hey, I made an acidic beer.
Yeah. And no. I think a lot of brewers, particularly professional brewers, have kind of gotten that. I see less and less of that. But occasionally you do come across one and you think, man, this might have been a good beer, you know. But
if the acid were a different kind of acid,
right? If it wasn't so harsh.
Yeah.
And you know, in the beginning, I think that our arms race with IPAs, you know, to make ever more alcoholic and ever more hoppy, you know, 120 IBU, 11% double IPA. When they started making acidic beers, it was the same way. Our sour beers are like, the more acid, the better.
Mm-hmm.
And it just ain't so. On either case, really, neither of them are, are really desirable things. I mean, I get it. You know, we're Americans. We think bigger is better. But I think, you know, that's not always true. In fact, it's not often true. Subtlety.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Fal drives an F-350 dually, just so you know.
You know, I drive a crappy Toyota Tacoma.
Do you really?
Yeah,
oh,
I
picked the opposite end of the pickup truck spectrum. Yeah. That's awesome.
In fact, you know, every time my girlfriend sees one of those gigantic trucks with those gigantic wheels, the guy spent a fortune, you know, on suspension and everything, it drives by and she says, sorry about your dude, sorry about your dick, dude.
I thought you were going to say, oh, I could be dating him.
No. I wonder if he's single.
No, I shouldn't say that. She says, sorry about your dick, dude.
Sorry, bro.
So, besides that big mistake, biggest mistake, you know, make sure you get to know your acids and you're going to have a good time. That's from Fal.
Yeah.
Where do people get the book?
You can get it on Amazon, which is shocking. Actually, the cheapest place I think you can get it is on Amazon.
How do you get the most money?
How do I? People write me and say, hey, send me a book. Here's my $20. Send me cash.
Totally. Do you have Venmo?
I have Venmo. Listen, you send me an email. My email is easy.
Venmo.
Fallen@avbc.com.
F-A-L-L-E-N.
Yeah. @AVBC, like Anderson Valley Brewing Company. And really, you can write and ask me any question you want about beer, anything of a non-personal nature. And
don't ask about trucks.
I heard your clarification.
Yeah. I heard your girlfriend likes small wieners. Yeah, I'll cut it out in post, yeah.
You know, people. I encourage people to email me, you know, if you got questions about beer, brewing, you want a book, send me $20 any way you want, Venmo, check, credit card, I'll take it in exchange, I'll take it in chicken eggs,
yeah,
and I'll mail you a book.
That's
the way I make the most money.
One more thing, Anderson Valley Beer distributed where? For our
everywhere?
Countrywide, worldwide.
Yeah, is it all 50 states?
No. We're in, you know, my boss would be a better guy to answer this. He's our sales guy. He manages all of that. I believe we're in about 32 states, which is, you know, most of the places you'd expect beer. And I believe we're in 16 countries now. Most of Southeast Asia, most of Europe, some of South America. I don't think we're in Africa yet, although... One never knows.
No.
All they have to do is ask, I think.
Yeah.
You know, we actually do pretty well in Asia, and that's where, you know, the bulk of our exports are. And in some places in Europe. Europe's a little more of a different market. You know, I think the Europeans are still struggling with the fact that they made all this awesome beer, and then Americans came along, copied them, innovated on top of the copy, and now they... innovation is the American thing. And they're like, what?
Wait a minute.
What happened? How are they the ones making good beer? Why? We have nothing to learn from them.
Can't believe they didn't look across the board of industry and didn't see that one coming. Sorry, shout out to our European friends.
Yeah, you know, see what you get for, see what you get for sharing as a brewer?
Yeah. All right, on that note. Fal, thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me. This has been a lot of fun.
It was a great time. Scott, thanks for coming in yourself.
You're welcome. Pleasure having all these Anderson Valley beers. Ball Hornin', baby.
Yeah, Ball Hornin'.
Since 1987?
That is right.
Bevo's been around since 1987.
She's old school.
Wait.
Thanks, Bevo.
I sure have.
Thanks to the fans. Thanks to the sponsors. Until next time, stay sour.
Ball Hornin'!
It's sour and it's bready and it's delicious.
Awesome.
I mean, come on.